cigarettes and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true will always love you, no matter what you do.
Rise is the light, the light, the light, the light, the light. Rise the light, the light, the light. Rise is the light, the light, the light. Your light, your light. Rise the light, your light, the light.
This is for soldiers who bust their guns and the name of freedom, not the game of fun.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. Welcome to the 10 for 10 edition of Spitfire,
Yay!
Women of Color Radio, every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. $10 for $10 for $10. It's Spitfire's 10-year anniversary. 10, 10, 10.
That's right. We're celebrating Spitfire's 10th year of broadcasting from the CKUT station in Montreal. The 10th year of broadcasting women of color voices on the FM dial every last Wednesday of the month, bringing to our local and global people honest and true content straight from the hearts of the creative and beautiful women of color radio collective.
Spitfire's 10th year coincides with CKUT's 25th anniversary. So happy birthday and let the fundraising festivities continue. Today, we are asking our listeners to make a contribution to your favorite radio show, A Spitfire, on the FM dial. Pledge $10 to CKUT and Spitfire for another year of amazing programming.
And we also have a pair of tickets to the Hal and Community Show at La Sala Rosa on November 8th, featuring the incredible D.V. Young. So for all of those that pledge to Spitfire, actually not for all of those who pledge to Spitfire, but the first person to pledge
Listen
to
up
Spitfire
now.
Will get these amazing concert tickets. So call into the show and we'll announce the winner at the end.
Tonight, we've got a great show in store. Alyssa will bring you another edition of the Spitfire Roundup, where we share highlights from news stories outside the margins.
Malek will be recapping a lecture by Professor Joanne St. Louis titled Race, Representation, and Black Women in Public Life, Imagining Michelle Obama, and facilitating a roundtable discussion on that lecture. Nicole had the opportunity to interview visionary artist, social activist, and member of Just Seeds, Fabiana Rodriguez, about her ongoing poster and print exhibition at CADGB. All this coming up next on Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio.
Thank you. hurry up and get aboard. We're shoving off in a minute.
Right now, before we go anyplace else, I want you to go with me to a special place.
How would you like to go on a little expedition? Sure.
Where will you think you're going?
I'm gonna take a long trip.
On a journey to anywhere you could draw your own map.
It's far, far away.
According to my navigation, this is a
very excited listener.
One of the strangest adventures.
He never could find the shortest distance between two points.
And all places are alike to me.
I always travel with the window open.
Where does this lead us in our investigation?
Out for a stroll in the fresh air.
Well, according to my gauges, we're about
out of this world.
This place is out of this world.
Ah, it's marvelous to be able to converse with people all over the world. People different to yourself with something new to say broadens your outlook, increases your knowledge of things.
Just me and my radio.
Born in Montreal, Canada. If you pitch in, if you really pitch in and play the game, if you really help out, I promise you in writing, we will have a ball.
Please support the funding drive at CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. Call 514-907-9424 to make a donation and help keep community radio on the air.
A Spitfire Roundup. The Color Purple turns 30. On September 28th of this year, the international best-selling novel, The Color Purple, reached its 30th anniversary since publication. The novel, written by acclaimed African-American author, poet, activist, and womanist Alice Walker, won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award for Fiction, making Miss Walker the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize. The novel follows the life of Celie, a young black girl living in the American South in the 1920s. It is a snapshot of the lives of black people in the American South during the 1920s through the 1940s, before the peak of the civil rights movement. The novel has been the frequent target of censors over the years and appears on the American Library Association list of the 100 most frequently challenged books of the last 10 years, coming in at number 17. Walker experienced heavy criticism, particularly among African Americans, concerned that the portrayal and explicit nature of violence against black women within the black community was somehow a violation of an unwritten rule that we should not air our dirty laundry in public, which is why we love this novel so much and it is so brave. So shout out to Sister Alice Walker, who continues to live and breathe the womanist politics she helped develop and who deserves the tributes and love she has gotten since this masterful work was published. Attention, attention. Conservative Supreme Court in the U.S. could end affirmative action as we know it. Voting rights for people of color on the chopping block. Pay attention this fall as two critical cases that were definitive outcomes of the civil rights movement are being heard at the highest court of the U.S., which definitely spells trouble. The first, Fisher versus University of Texas, is a case currently before the U.S. Supreme Court concerning the affirmative action admissions policy of the University of Texas at Austin. The case, brought by a white female undergraduate student, Abigail Fisher, in 2008, asks the court either declare the admissions policy of the university inconsistent with or entirely overrule a 2003 case from Michigan in which the court ruled that race could play a limited role in the admissions policies of universities, for instance, in efforts to promote diversity. This case could end affirmative action policies in U.S. public universities. The court agreed to hear the case earlier this year, and oral arguments began in the second week of October. Much of the questioning by conservative justices Alito, Scalia, and Roberts follows some of the more common attacks against affirmative action, that it is essentially a quota system racially discriminating against otherwise qualified candidates by an unfairly admitting people who do not meet a standard of excellence. However, it should be noted that the University of Texas, the defendant in this case, does not use race in a quota system, but rather as a relevant factor among several factors to get a holistic picture of the candidates they admit when these students apply to university. For instance, they look at parental status, whether there was one or two parents in the home of a child applying, socioeconomic status, extenuating circumstances, extracurricular activities, with race playing one role amongst all of these factors, not being an exclusive category for admission. Affirmative action has been under consistent, systematic attack since it emerged to address the fact that higher education throughout much of North America has been almost exclusively white, and that people of color were deliberately excluded from these institutions. Let us not forget that nobody thought it was a good idea for people of color to go to university in North America until we, people of color, took it upon ourselves to educate everyone else that it is in fact our right. We may be speaking in the closing months of the end of the era of affirmative action, and unfortunately embarking on a return to a dark age of public education where university looks a lot like white. The second case, Shelby County v. Holder, is awaiting petition but could soon be certified to be heard by the Supreme Court. The lawsuit was initiated by the Attorney General of Alabama, with five other Republican-led states signing on in support. The issue in this case is whether Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is constitutional. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, as many of you know, is a landmark piece of legislation in the United States that outlawed discriminatory voting practices responsible for the widespread disenfranchisement of African Americans in the U.S. It is one of the two most important legislative outcomes of the freedom movement and was signed into law by Lyndon Baines Johnson. Echoing the language of the 15th Amendment, the Voting Rights Act prohibits states from imposing any, open quote, voting qualification or prerequisite to voting, or standard, or practice, or procedure, to deny or abridge the right of any citizen of the United States to vote on account of race or color, close quote. Specifically, Congress intended the act to outlaw the practice of requiring otherwise qualified voters to pass literacy tests in order to register to vote, a principal means by which Southern states had prevented African Americans from exercising the franchise. For example, while there was never a law on the books that said you, yes, you, are black, therefore you cannot vote even though you were born in this state and in this county. Instead, insidious tactics were used, such as asking people to take such so-called tests, which they would always fail because the rules of the test were made up with the point of disenfranchisement. There are 9 states covered by the Voting Rights Act, mostly the former Confederate states in the South, but there are counties that are in other states that are also under the jurisdiction of the Voting Rights Act. Shelby County, Alabama, has filed one challenge to this Voting Rights Act in court, arguing that while Section 5 served a noble purpose when it was signed in 1965, that, quote, things have changed in the South, close quote. Given the reminiscent nature of the 1960s currently, as times led by Republican-led legislatures to suppress the vote through quite similar tactics for the upcoming presidential election, one questions the sincerity and merit of such a statement. The Supreme Court has yet to decide whether it will hear this case for sure, but it's very close, so keep a lookout for that. Finally, on a more somber and note north of the border, we say farewell to a Canadian icon. This month saw the death of the legendary civil rights activist and lawyer Charles Roach, who succumbed to a long battle with cancer. Mr. Roach was originally from Trinidad and Tobago and came to Canada in 1955 to study at the University of Saskatchewan. He studied law after that at the University of Toronto and was called to the bar in 1963. Roach worked as a staff lawyer for the City of Toronto, while also participating in organizing marches and demonstrations for equal rights. He opened his own law practice in 1968, and among his clients were Black Panthers, attempting to seek refuge in Canada from prosecution in the U.S., and other asylum seekers. He also represented domestic workers facing deportation in the 1970s. He was a vocal critic of the police, routinely challenging their racially profiling practices in the City of Toronto and elsewhere. Roach was a founder of the Caravana Festival, serving as its first chair. He established the movement of minority electors in 1978 to encourage non-whites to enter electoral politics and was a founding member of the Black Action Defense Committee. Roach took the issue of allegiance to the Canadian monarch to federal court. as he was a member and executive committee member of the Citizens for a Canadian Republic. In fact, Roach refused to obtain Canadian citizenship because he rejected the oath of citizenship as it contains a promise to bear allegiance to the Canadian monarch. Roach tried to sue many times on the grounds that the allegiance violates the Charter of Rights and Freedoms because it forces us to pledge allegiance to the sovereign being the monarch. He has gone to court, and as recently as 2012, a Superior Court judge allowed the case to continue. Mr. Roach is in our thoughts this month, and we send our warmest regards to his family and loved ones all over the world.
CKUT? Anybody home? Hello, CKUT? Anybody home?
Don't let this happen. Make your pledge to CKUT's funding drive.
From October 25th to November 4th, 2012.
Have you ever wondered what your radio would sound like without CKUT?
Arrancando los motores.
We will enjoy an excellent commercial pilot programming.
Imagine the Canadian Top 10 music, the best gossips of your favorite artists, with the best sponsors and the official news that are happening in Montreal City, Canada country, and in the world wide. So, do you guess who is behind of this beautiful change? Yes, you got it! The Monster of the Silence and his horrible laughing. This monster not only wants to put pieces of masking tape in our mouths for avoid any opinion or disagreement, also he wants broadcast commercial programming and official news in order to transform CKUT in the voice of the power. Do you really want this for CKUT? Come on, don't give up. You have to participate in the funding drive of CKUT. How? Pledge online on www.ckut.ca. Also, pledge on telephone line 514-907-9424. 514-907-9424. Come on, don't give up. CKUT, 25 years strong.
Welcome back to Spitfire here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are smack dab in the middle of CKUT's annual funding drive happening from October 25 to November 4. We're asking all those listeners out there to help us celebrate Spitfire's 10-year run on air by donating to CKUT. The first caller to make a pledge on Spitfire will be entered in a draw at the end of the show to win a pair of tickets to DB Young's concert on November 8th at Sala Rosa, and she is hot, so y'all want to get those tickets. Mm-hmm. All right, back to our regular programming. Joanne St. Louis, a nationally recognized and multi-award-winning law professor at the University of Ottawa, was at the McGill Law Faculty this past month giving a talk entitled Race, Representation, and Black Women in Public Life, Imagining Michelle Obama. Throughout the talk, Professor St. Louis highlighted a few key images used by the media, mainstream and otherwise, to portray Michelle Obama. The first was from a July 21, 2008 cover of The New Yorker.
Image of The New Yorker.
this image of Michelle Obama as this revolutionary. And picturing that, what was interesting to me on a range of ways with it is that there is a stereotype and a set of stereotypes that attach to it. So I'm not tackling the Muslim issue for the moment. What I was fascinated by was the issue of power and the dynamic of power. She is carrying the weapon. She has the bullets. He's the one in the religious garb carrying nothing at all. She is the mysterious, probably greater threat sitting in that office physically. She looks really angry. And if you read some of the articles about her, there's this continual theme of the angry black woman. The theme of the angry black woman is not a new theme. The theme of the black matriarch who somehow emasculates black men, particularly in the American context, has been there for decades. So when Daniel Monahan did his piece looking at the nature of the black family, the blame was laid clearly on an overdeveloped power that black women appeared to have, which emasculated black men. And in many ways, that image to me conjured up that notion. Who really is in control of the White House? It actually had as a caption, "The Politics of Fear," as the caption. And I thought, who was the most feared character in the picture? Who was the most overtly threatening character in the picture in a range of ways? The other thing about the image, for those of you who are film buffs or who might be as old as I am, it conjured up the black spirit.
So that's one image of the scary Michelle Obama, quite appropriate for Halloween. And as if that were not troubling enough, Professor St. Louis also addressed the repeated portrayals in the new media of the internet blogosphere of Michelle Obama as a chimpanzee.
Each one in detail, but the recurring motif of her as a chimpanzee is disturbing. It is very, very disturbing because the source of that is actually, you are going quite far back, right? We're going to the period of slavery, where the whole issue was whether black people were fully human. So that whole period of scientific racism that found our features to be ape-like, partially darkness of skin, not even necessarily anybody with eyes to see, necessarily ape-like, but that continual notion of the capering monkey. In fact, there's a period of time when you're in the 1920s and 30s where there were postcards that people bought, and the postcard was often of a monkey, but meant to be a very much a black person. So this sort of a higher level monkey dressed in a suit, very thick lips, capering, and unaware of how, you know what, you're never really going to be part of that society. You're kind of playing at being fully part of us, is sort of the underlying message with all of these kinds of images. So when you...
Another particularly troubling portrayal of Michelle Obama that Professor St. Louis touched on was the discussion of Michelle Obama's body.
Idea of her body is probably the one that is most disturbing for me because it's the most insidious in some ways. Mm-hmm. So Michelle Obama initiates a policy that speaks to America being healthier, eating better. Now, I don't know about you, but that woman is one of the fittest women I've ever seen. In fact, a lot of the stereotypes actually go to the hypermasculinity that they sort of hyper-exaggerate her arms and her biceps and her triceps because of how fit she is. So it becomes fascinating to me that the caricatures of her in terms of critiquing the validity of that policy initiative of hers is to make her extremely fat. It is to show her at a table with a mound of hamburgers calling to Obama for more bacon for her hamburgers. That's fascinating to me. It is fascinating to hear Rush Limbaugh say that if she wants to advance this policy, she should look more like an Ethiopian. That's one of the words he wanted. It is even more daunting to me that he would think it okay to satirize and speak about her big butt. Being black, I would say I should I would go the other way and say, a lot of people have no butts. That's what the problem is. And so, in fact, what we're talking about is aesthetics. We're not actually remotely talking. This is not the cook that Deans, Ms. Deans, who, you know, basically there was a hypocrisy fundamentally between her own health, her own approach to her health, and the way in which she was marketing, and her job was the selling of food and being a chef and all of those pieces. This is not Michelle Obama's problem. And yet, were you to just hear this through these shock jocks, through these conversations, and why? They're not at the margins anymore. Years ago, we'd have said, oh, you know what? Who listens to those programs? We're in a new reality. Lots of people listen to these programs. They shape the understanding of what is really happening. And it is fascinating to me that at the same time that we are fighting as women to talk about things like anorexia, to actually talk about the nature of the body, that the way you're going to actually satirize the First Lady is because you think, because they can't say anything about any other part of her body, that you think her buttocks are too large. Now let's just move back. Let's go back to 1810. You have Sergeant Barton. You have a coy woman who is brought to Europe and exhibited repeatedly for the purposes of people observing her unique body structure, including her genitalia. When this woman dies prematurely, they excise her skeleton, her genitalia, and her brain. The genitalia in particular are on display until 1974. In 1994, Nelson Mandela attempts to repatriate her remains, and that does not happen until 2002. From the Museum of Egypt. That issue and politics of black women's bodies, and particularly the way in which our bodies are constructed, is not an accidental thing. So when Jim Sensenberger said...
Finally, keeping on the theme of mainstream representations of black bodies, Professor St. Louis brought up the August 2012, very recent, cover of Spain's Fuera de Serie magazine, which was created by superimposing Michelle Obama's face onto the body of the black enslaved woman shown in the 1800 Portrait d'une Négresse by French artist Marie-Guillaume Benoit.
Do I want us to have this huge chill where people have to be perfected? Their humor has to be sensitive and always hit the right note. No. But I think there is something fundamentally and profoundly disrespectful. And Spanish magazine with your own disturbing colonial history, using a painting that I believe is by a French artist of a black woman who would have had no choice to pose for you with her breast exposed, because the convention for portraiture at the time, and some of you may have heard Professor Charmaine Nelson here speak about these issues, was that white women were covered. So the woman, for her to be sitting there that way, and the actual portrait is unnamed, because why would you know who she is? Why does it matter? Bodies are interchangeable. It's a black body. It's for consumption. And that's the image you chose. You didn't Photoshop her on the Venus de Milo and then decide to darken the Venus de Milo. That might have been an interesting communication to me. That might have been an interesting separate set of issues. That might have raised something. In all honesty, that would have raised some interesting tensions about what was being said, because then you're taking something viewed in European art and culture as archetypally beautiful. I might have been able to say, well, maybe you're saying something about her being appropriate to that, that you're not actually trying to degrade the Venus de Milo, you're trying to say something else. That's not what this is. So no amount of writing your little apology on a blog is going to convince yours truly that you have not made a big misstep.
A big misstep indeed. So, what are we to make of these images? Here, Professor St. Louis makes a few points. First, about the racist context of these images.
Meaningful and defensible is because they're saying something about that individual. What I'm going to say about these images is that these images are actually not new. They're not imaginative. They're not creative. They're decades, and in some cases, hundreds of year-old images that are not meant for Michelle Obama, they're meant for the entire black community. They have been excavated and polished anew, and they're being used on both of them, but my focus is on Michelle Obama for the time being. And that makes it really profoundly inappropriate. It makes it impossible for them to be stripped of their racist roots, regardless of the functional amnesia of the individual who at that moment thinks they've engaged in something interesting and particularly brilliant.
The second, and I would argue more profound point Professor St. Louis makes is about the way in which these sorts of attacks are, quote, actually having a chilling effect on some of the benefit we reap from Michelle Obama being directly engaged and outspoken as the First Lady. Because since she doesn't actually need to do anything to be highly criticized and highly contentious, it's very difficult for us to measure what she would be like absent a kind of racist style of discourse and caricature that has been put upon her, as we've seen with these illustrations. So, we have our first African-American First Lady. Yippee. This is undoubtedly a cause for celebration, but because of the way in which this woman has been silenced, because every time she steps out, gets a racist smackdown, our excitement is dampened in the face of these repeated attempts to whitewash and mute her experiences and her point of view, and ultimately those of all contemporary black women and women of color in public life. Professor St. Louis says it best when she says the following.
Ways in which Michelle Obama is critiqued as an angry woman is every time she speaks about the continuing racism and injustice in America. Apparently, that makes her an angry black woman. It doesn't make her a thoughtful lawyer. It doesn't make her a social justice advocate. It apparently shows a tremendous amount of ingratitude, a lack of patriotism, and exactly what we don't want in a First Lady who should be, I guess, a gentle, self-effacing flower saying, I am so very grateful that my husband and I are getting to live in this big white house.
So at this point, I'm going to open the floor to my fellow Spitfires and ask you guys, where do you stand on some of these issues? So first question, where should responsible media draw the line between legitimate satire, caricature, political cartoon, and blatant bigotry, hate speech, and the peddling of prejudice? Feel free to jump in.
Everyone's being too polite. Everyone is being too polite.
Got some black women being silent up in here.
It's a lot to take in, that's why.
Well, yeah. I just wanted to reiterate how exhausting this is to just constantly have to be faced with the image of a black woman in any kind of public sphere likened to a monkey. It's kind of exhausting. Anytime you have a successful black woman, whether she be in entertainment, whether she be, television, music, the White House, the first African-American First Lady, there's just this recurring archive of imagery that's not new. It's not interesting. It's not saying anything new. It is just about likening women's bodies to that of apes. And it's free speech. It's a marketplace of ideas. We're supposed to live in a pluralistic society, but I feel that the way that the media allows that to go on without calling it for what it is, regardless of whether or not it should be said or not, is as much a problem as the fact that it's allowed to be said.
Completely.
So it's almost like the way that the media is refereed. And who's refereeing that media allows these images, this outpouring of racial hatred against the first black head of state of the U.S. empire, to go unchecked, which creates a climate for all of us. Like, it's endogenous to our society. It's not something external that's being brought. It's something that comes out, and we're allowing it to come out. And we as people who are impacted by these images on a daily basis, have no say on how they're refereed because we don't have access to that cultural capital. We're not in the media rooms of CNN and CBS News and NBC News and Meet the Press and where these things should be talked about, because she is a woman. She is the female head of state, in a way. She is the spouse of the President of the United States. This should be a political discussion. And there's no representation in that sphere of media to challenge this and to hold people like this Spanish publication accountable. So that's what I'd like to say.
I just I completely agree with everything you said, except I do want to challenge this point that Michelle Obama is a head of state in terms of politics and policy. And that's kind of one of the points that she made in the present that Professor St. Louis made in the presentation. We didn't get to play that clip because we have limited time, but she talks about how historically satire, caricature, political cartoons, it's all designed to get your attention, to make a point about a certain policy, and that what Michelle Obama is being criticized on is not anything that she's done, but purely who she is. So even in the example of her one policy initiative, which is very mild, hey, let's eat healthier, the critique is about what her body looks like. Oh, you have a big butt. It's a matter of, which we know is a very old racial trope against Black women. So it's really just about who she is, and something that she can't change or that she didn't really have a hand in. It's not really about her policy or anything that she's doing. And I would say that that's really the point where it becomes bigotry as opposed to any kind of satire.
Jasmine, what do you want? What do you think?
I think also, like, drawing off of Alyssa's point is that just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should. And the fact that there's no outcry from Black women groups all over the U.S. it just kind of reiterates and reinforces the fact that
we can't hear that outcry exactly. Because they don't have the access to
those resources, right?
Exactly.
So, like, even if I hear this or I read this while I'm on the bus on my way to school, how am I supposed to make an impact on the international community?
Right.
Because I have no resources to make that point, to enforce it. And, like, for example, focusing on another subset of oppressed people, in, like, if we focus on, like, the concept of, like, homosexuals in the U.S., if Rush Limbaugh had said something that offensive solely based on stereotypical homosexual norms, I'm sure he would have lost his job. I'm sure he would have lost his job for that.
But he did call, like, this year he has called a Georgetown law student a slut and a prostitute, mm-hmm. and asked her to perform sexual acts mm-hmm. in front of him for him to watch, when she just raised the issue that maybe women under 25 should have access to birth control.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So I would be skeptical to sort of say that this is endemic to Black women specifically. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely a large market for hate speech in the U.S. And I don't think
Completely.
I think there's a specific way it's targeted towards Black people, but I don't think that excludes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
I hear you, though, because, I mean, look at the way that Tracy Morgan had to walk back something that was homophobic that he said.
Mm-hmm, right.
I wonder how much hate speech Rush Limbaugh would get vis-a-vis...
Exactly. The point is you would hear more outcry, right? Like, that's the bottom line, is that you would hear more outcry if this was focused on other subsets of the U.S. population versus just Black women in general.
I want to draw up this point that you're making, Jasmine, about... you know, outcry and why don't we hear anything, and something that I feel like Professor St. Louis was really drawing on in her talk was this whole issue of silence and how women have really been silenced in terms of not being able to speak, because there is this automatic negative repercussion and racial tropes and sort of public punishment for speaking out. And, yeah, I just want to open it up again to ask, in your experience, what has happened to you, or what have you seen happen more broadly to women of color who do try to speak up?
I mean, I lived in the U.S. for most of my life, and I feel like because, in general, legally speaking, there isn't really a prejudice against Black people, and it's only seen through indirect ways. Mm-hmm. People don't take insult personally anymore.
Mm.
Like, if someone is going to say something about my race and then I see it, you know, in my everyday life, I can't go to a certain school or I can't, you know, go into a certain establishment, then I feel like I would have more of a personal investment in speaking up. Whereas now, it's almost like in music, when people talk against women, you know, a woman would just say, well, he's not talking about me, so I'm going to keep dancing.
Right.
So it's sort of like you don't necessarily want to, not that you don't want to, but from what I've seen in other African-American people is that, why make a big deal out of it? You know, maybe it's not my problem. I'm just going to keep, you know, dancing to the song, calling me a a bee.
Yeah, which is, like, so crazy that, like, you know, Professor St. Louis was talking about how these are, like, ridiculously racist, epithets and insults to the First Lady. And so, like, what does it mean to have, like, you know, the First Lady being degraded in this way?
Right.
And, like, you know, someone who's, like, not in the White House, someone who's just this regular person, or maybe someone who's, like, below income or, like, undereducated or dealing with a lot of different challenges, like, systemically. Like, how is, you know, an African-American person going to feel like they can actually participate in society when the First Lady is brought to such shame?
Definitely.
You know, reduced to a subspecies or...
I just think it comes to the fact that we've become so desensitized as a society
Absolutely.
To what is appropriate and what is offensive that it's just everything goes. Even in, like, coming back to what Melissa was saying about music, it's just you can hear, like, the N-word and everybody's going to be saying it.
Right.
And as soon as, let's say, an African-American person goes, don't
That's
say it,
cool.
it's kind of like, oh, no, but LL Cool J says it, Jay-Z says it, it's all good. And then you see, let's say, with this whole thing with Michelle Obama, as soon as... a black woman would say, you need to stop. This is not who she is. She's there representing, you know, a strong black woman trying to further us in society and kind of move us forward. Then we're being told, why are you being so mad? Why are you being so angry? Like,
you know what's crazy is, like, we've even gotten this kind of reaction about our show. I don't know if Victoria or Alyssa, who've been part of the show for a while, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary, by the way, but a reaction that I've gotten is, like, oh, I don't understand why it just has to be a woman of color collective and you guys are just complaining, and that women are portrayed, and women of color specifically, when we speak up or when we say, hey, that's not okay, we're portrayed as complaining or squawk, squawk, squawk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is actually something...
Sorry.
Honestly, that's what it is. And this is actually something that Professor St. Louis brought up in her talk. Again, we didn't get to play it, but she talks about this kind of rush to innocence anytime that racism is called out. So you have people saying things like, oh, I didn't mean it that way, or what I meant was something completely different. Oh, how many times have you heard this? You're really being too sensitive. Oh, that's just political correctness. Oh, you can't take a joke. Oh, I'm sure she thinks it's okay, and, you know, on and on and on. And so it's really your problem if you're offended at prejudice.
I just want to say this quick before I forget. I was watching a new show this week, and we have to wrap up soon, so I'm just going to mention this quickly. The AP, the Associated Press, released a study saying that racial prejudice in the U.S. has actually increased since Obama took office. So all this talk about him ushering in the post-racial era, really, maybe it just unleashed a darker era.
And what's crazy is that in the talk, what Professor St. Louis was saying is because she's the First Lady, they have to do media control. They need to do, like, public relations control for the U.S. elections. They cannot respond
And Obama's up for a second term, so you can't have his angry black wife.
Right? So they don't actually respond to any of these attacks at all in order to not bring attention, you know, to things that might be inflated in the media during the election time. So, we got to wrap this segment up. Any last thoughts?
Yeah, I guess a last thing to think about for us and for listeners out there is one of the things that Professor St. Louis brought up is the effect that new media has had. So, for example, Michelle Obama has been portrayed as a chimpanzee, and that's something that even on Rush Limbaugh you wouldn't get away with, but it's all over these anonymous internet blogs, and because it becomes so popular and it spreads like wildfire, there was a time in 2009 where if you Googled Michelle Obama, that was the first image that came up. But on a hopeful note, what we're trying to do here is to be part of that new media. And so something that I would be helpful for us to think about, I think, is what is our responsibility in the context of this new social media to have our voice heard and to counteract this very prevalent sort of prejudice. So listen on for our attempts to do that throughout this show and in the coming months.
Definitely. Thanks a lot, Malek, for this awesome little roundtable discussion we had here on this amazing talk. And now we're going to go to an interview that our awesome member of the collective who couldn't be here today, Nicole, prepared with Fabiana Rodriguez.
is that it is also internalized.
Shoot. Okay, maybe we're not going to do that. I'm just going to figure out what's going on.
You want me to put the song?
Yeah.
To that. It is something so a very conservative.
You want me to put the song on?
Sure.
Okay. You said you'd be there for me.
Nice words, John. We could have gone on so much longer than that. And likewise, you should do that all the time. It's from I know. We could have done Taviana next month, even.
I think
we
play it now.
The reason I said next month is because I know this is till the end of November. Oh, no, no, sorry, we go on again.
Nous avions envoyé un gros remerciement à nos commanditaires qui nous ont fait parvenir de la nourriture pendant notre campagne de financement. Merci à Eau Vive, Café Bistro El Mundo, Carlos et Pepe, Casa del Popolo, le dépanneur Le Pickup, IM Café, Fairmount Bagel, Fuchsia Épicerie Fleu, Hoang One Sandwich, La Lumière du Mile End, Le Frigo Vert, Lola Rosa, Mango Bay, McGill Pizza, Restaurant chez Toto, Saint-Viateur Bagel et True Juice. La campagne de financement de CKUT n'aurait pas pu être possible sans ces commerces et on apprécie leur contribution.
On Saturday, October 28th, the wall space of Kajibi was taken over the colorful and political posters of Fabiana Rodriguez. Fabiana Rodriguez posters come in a myriad of shapes and sizes and colors, but all of them carry the same prominent message, and that is of resistance. Resistance to capitalism norms, resistance to smashing power, resistance and resistance to the notion that people need documents for their identity to be realized. Her posters speak to the immigrant families, communities, and societies that are spread across North America and Turtle Island wide. Her posters encapture families, poverty, work, multiculturalism, foreign worker status, death, pain, love, and beauty, while all of them also carry an important message about the stark reality that hundreds, thousands, and millions of immigrants face every year. That is the reality of deportation and an ongoing fight to give status to anyone and everyone, regardless of their racial background, the color of their skin, their ethnicity, their language, their gender, their sexual orientation. Her posters are vibrant and strong, and her message is loud and clear. Moments before her vernissage at Kajibi, I had the opportunity to talk to Fabiana about the message she tries to represent in her posters and part of the creative process that she goes through to get there.
My name is Fabiana Rodriguez, and I'm a visual artist based in Oakland, California. And I do a lot of artwork dealing with immigration, globalization, women's issues, queer issues, and sexual liberation.
What brings you to Montreal this time around?
This time around, I'm here for this exhibit that I'm a part of, and I was also here for the Culture Shock Festival, and just to talk about migrant rights and how we can support each other.
How long have you been an artist?
Well, I actively started making political posters when I was about 17 years old. So that was about 17 years ago. Since then, I've just been, you know, really focused on using the image as a way to support resistance and to support movement work around the world.
When you were 17, what was the defining moment that influenced you to start making posters that were more political as opposed to just art for the sake of expressionism?
I've always wanted to be an artist. Even as a child, I knew I wanted to be an artist, and the kind of art I was exposed to was usually art by white European men. And it really didn't reflect me. It didn't reflect some of the urgency of the time that was happening. When I was 16, it was 1994, and that's the year that then President Clinton passed NAFTA. It was also the year of the beginning of some of the worst anti-immigrant laws being passed throughout the United States, starting in California, my home state. So it was a turning moment for me because I realized that the doors were opening for big multinational corporations, and the people who were going to pay the price were migrants. And my family being a migrant family themselves, many of my family members had come to the U.S., I found it really appalling the way in which mainstream media criminalized migrants, criminalized Latinos overall, people of color, and just consistently framed everything in our against us. So for me, making art was a statement against that, and it was a way to feel empowered and to tell our story.
What is the process like for you when you're developing a new idea that you're trying to put onto print?
Well, first, I do a lot of research. I spend a lot of time informing myself about news events and getting a sense of what kind of laws are being passed, what's the dominant narrative out there in the media, what's the way that things are being framed, what are some specific ways that we can move people to action. So I look at that first, and then I think about what I want to say, whether it's something that is about supporting a particular kind of campaign, or even if it's not related to a campaign at all. I think about what I'm going to say, and I think about exactly what kind of impact I want to make on the viewer, and then I think about my design. But I usually start with an idea that I'm really passionate about, and it kind of flows from there. I don't ever feel like I'm at a lack of ideas. On the contrary, I feel like I'm not moving fast enough with all the issues I want to kind of cover.
So you would very much say that your art is grounded in a counterculture and
totally.
Alternative media.
Of course. I mean, my work's grounded in the daily occurrences where we see our rights being stomped on. I mean, not just, for example, not just migrant rights or women's rights, but even right about what we're eating or right to know about what contains GMOs or where our food's coming from, who's responsible for the economic crisis that's hit many of us. Those are all the things that concern me.
I've seen a few of your pieces here at Kijibi, and I've seen that your newer prints are really working with a very unique style in comparison to some of your older prints. Where did the inspiration come for these newer ones?
For the newer prints, I just constantly am changing my style. I don't like to do the same thing. I get a little bored if I keep doing the same posters. So I just try to always push myself artistically. I don't just make posters. I also make, you know, abstract prints. I'm exploring installation now more and other media. I more just see it as a growth in my process and in my style.
Do you have any words of advice to give to artists that are maybe not as established but are also interested in working in art that is on the fringe politics?
Yeah, my advice is that first you find people you want to collaborate with and you organize yourself in collectives and you really find yourself a support network, and that you understand that there's a business side of doing things. I mean, unfortunately, it's important to know how to sell your stuff, where to sell it, how to reach the people that care about the same things you care about. I don't think it's about selling out, but it's more how do you retain your economic independence so that you could do what you want to do and you don't have to get sucked up by the huge art market. Folks can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Fabiana, and that's with a V as in Victor and two N's. You could also find me on Facebook and Instagram.
And you have a website as well?
It's Fabiana.com.
Thank you, Nicole. Faviana's posters are on display from now until the end of November. So if you're in the neighborhood, be sure to drop by Kajibi on the corner of Saint-Laurent and Saint-Viateur to see just how vibrant and moving her prints are for yourself. If you have not yet donated to Spitfire as part of CKUT 90.3 Funding Drive, you have still got a chance to get tickets to the B Youngs concert.
Do it.
You want to go.
What's the number?
So, first of all, we're going to announce how much CKUT made. We're happy to announce that CKUT made $27,020.80.
Almost halfway there to their goal of $60,000.
Yep. So we're still trying to reach $60,000. Keep bringing those pledges. And if you haven't already pledged your $10 to Spitfire as part of our 10-year anniversary, you can always log on to ckut.ca to pledge online